Blog Talk Radio.
Options show for June 30th, 2013. And how did we get to June 30th already? Isn't that amazing? With Richard Olson. And Sherry Edwards may be able to be dropping in. She's a little under the weather. She just got through with a week-long, eight-hour-a-day class. And if she can, she'll be joining us. But not for the moment. Possibly on WebEx. I'm not sure if WebEx is going to be happening because I can't do that at the same time and run the board for the audio portion of the show. So for now, we're going to be audio only, which is my world, so that is fabulous. And perhaps when Sherry comes in or if she does get to come in, we'll be hearing about the keynote. But for now, there's so much information to talk to with Polly about. I'll read this short snippet and we will jump right into talking to Polly Halstead. Polly is the author of The Primal Cuisine, Cooking for the Paleo Diet. Polly began her culinary career in 1973, and with the publication of Primal Cuisine, Cooking for the Paleo Diet, Polly opens our eyes on the topics of GMOs, gluten and casein intolerance, and how our food choices impact the environment and our health. Also, I think she opens our eyes to fat as an ally. So I'd like to jump right on. Good morning, Polly. Whoops. Pardon me. There we go. Good morning, Polly. I don't know what happened.
Hey,
Blog
here
Talk,
we are.
Blog Talk Radio
California
took you
morning.
Up air for a moment. Now you're back.
Oh.
Good morning.
Okay.
I don't know. It's,
wow,
it's very.
Wow.
It is Mercury. It's Mercury retrograde, so it is very much an exciting time with the universe of the ones and zeros. It's a very exciting technical time.
Oh,
so
gosh.
I really did want. I actually did want to jump right into, and as you know, we'll have you know any number of directions. But I really did add that you know fat as an ally instead of an enemy. I'd like to jump right into that. You know that that's
okay,
really.
I can really jump right into that from my own experience. You know,
wonderful.
In my late teens, I became bulimic and slightly, you know, anorexic. And what I found out sort of since then is it can be triggered by a zinc deficiency, which I have. But all that aside, you know, I became totally phobic about my weight, everything I ate. I started eating all the low-fat foods. You know, thinking that was the right thing to do. And actually, it made the condition worse. I truly believe I became more mineral deficient during that time. And, you know, it's a very crazy kind of illness or psychological thing or whatever you want to call it. You know, you are really embarrassed by it, afraid of it. I couldn't talk to anybody about it, my parents, and when I got married, my husband or whatever, I hid the condition. It eventually kind of self-corrected, I think, as after I got married, I had to cook for us. So, you know, I got back into using butter and eating animal fats and stuff like that. So I think it sort of self-corrected on its own. And it was before, you know, there was a lot of information out on bulimia. Now people have heard of it. You know, we've had a lot of movie stars who've been bulimic or anorexic or whatever. So there's a lot more information on it. But then I thought I was just weird and the only one who was doing this. So at any rate, I think fat plays a major role in our health, and especially healthy fats as well. What I want to talk about too is is what I have learned is that fats, toxins are stored in fats. So when we eat animals that have been fed GMO grains, various pharmaceuticals, hormones, antibiotics, all that, all those things stay in the meat and especially the fats of the animals. So then when we eat those, those toxic fats, they stay in our bodies as well, in our fat cells. And that's why we have sort of accumulated toxins in our bodies. I mean, we're sort of at the top of the food chain on the planet, and so all those toxins add up and get stored in our fat cells and cause inflammation and a lot of diseases. So I think when we know this, we have to choose, if we're eating animals or animal products, we have to choose animals and their products that have not had any additional toxins in them. So that's one aspect of the fat thing
When you're talking about fats, you're really talking about whole food fats. You're not talking about pink milk or blue milk or any colored milk, you know, any of those weird color coding things that we have with low fat and no fat and all these weird, you know, fake filtered out milk products. You're talking about all whole fat foods. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, saturated fat. Saturated fat's been vilified, but saturated fat is butter. You know, it's the fats from the animals. It's the cholesterol. We evolved on a very significant high-fat diet. A lot of people think, you know, the caveman diet was just all meat, lean meat, or whatever. It wasn't. They ate the fatty parts of the animal first, because that helped stave off starvation. It was satisfying. It was nourishing. It was very high in cholesterol, which now they realize, it was the pure non-toxic fat at that time, but it really nourishes the brain. The brain is about 50% fat or cholesterol, so we still need that for the brain and for the heart.
And I think it was even Dave Asprey in his baby book, which I can't remember the complete title of, who wrote a book about, you know, having healthy babies and happy babies, talked about, you know, babies. There's actual research done showing that babies that have a whole food, whole fat, higher fat diet, not cereals and carbohydrates, but actually a fatty diet, develop, you know, larger, more developed brains. I'd have to refer to his material directly, but that's kind of the juxtaposition of, you know, what he's saying, is that whole fats and whole foods are exactly what you're saying. I mean, they're talking about healthier babies, healthier beings with real food, whole fats.
Absolutely. And in many indigenous cultures, you know, when a couple got married and knew they were going to conceive, both the husband and the wife were fed especially rich, high-fat diet for a while, so that even the conception of the child was going to be a nourishing one. So they knew this. They've known this for a long time, that the mother has to have that nourishment. And I really believe that a lot of women who suffer from postpartum depression now, of which I was one of those, it's because they have not fed themselves correctly when they were pregnant. So all during their pregnancy, they became nutrient deficient. And actually, then the baby is born more nutrient deficient as well. My daughter had severe colic when she was born. We can talk about, you know, what might cause that. But at any rate, I truly believe that, you know, the autism, the ADD epidemic that we're experiencing today in the U.S. with our children are the result of the nutrient deficiency of the parents, and it's progressive throughout the generations.
Well, now I'll toss out the phrase. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it, although I know we could. I would talk about the throw out the carbohydrate conspiracy is what I would call it. As I remember back in the 70s when I was studying with a nutritionist, Crispin Sullivan, that we actually talked way back then when it all began to happen. There was the actual spin happening about, you know, that's when we switched over to, well, grain breakfasts. Everything was a cereal for breakfast, and not only that, but they were high sugar, but that's a separate conspiracy. And, you know, how we were all steered away from fats and proteins toward carbohydrates because that was the industry that's what was being pushed. And it's really, now we're coming back into leaders like you who are saying, no, really, it's whole foods. Let's talk about whole, real foods, primal cuisines. You know, I think it's such a wonderful, you know, healthy way to go where, as you say, you know, your daughter had a deficiency because your daughter, your diet was possibly deficient, and that's how it cascades out. You know, if you're having children, you want to have a healthy diet, so your child comes out healthy and then, you know, is inclined toward a healthy diet. It's not rocket science.
No, and that's why I believe, you know, whether you call it the paleo diet or whatever, but I think the main thing is we have to go back to the prime diet. What is the prime diet that nourishes? It's protein, which replaces cells, and it's fats. And the fats and cholesterol, from what I understand, make the cell walls permeable so the protein can get into the cell and then create energy. You know, the metabolic process happens. But the low-fat foods actually make the cell walls stiffer, so then the proteins and other nutrients can't get in, and also the toxic byproducts can't get out. So with a low-fat diet, these cells are not working optimally. That's the way I understand it, that it works. So we need the fat.
We need the fats. That's,
cholesterol.
You know, that's part of the
cholesterol.
We need the, you know, it's been a lot of research is coming out more and more about fats being beneficial to lipid levels rather than fat being like the evil naysayer that it really is refined carbohydrates that are making our cholesterol levels higher. So it's really quite stunning.
And, I've read a little bit about this. I'm not an expert, but with some of the brain problems like Parkinson's and all of that, from what I understand, there isn't enough cholesterol coating the nerve ending. So we're getting a lot of brain short-circuiting. I believe that's happening with autism and ADD and all of that. Is it there isn't enough cholesterol coating, the nerve endings?
That seems to be so. If Sherry was here, I'm certain she would be wrapping it down. I'm not skilled enough or smart enough to have that information at my fingertips, but I totally believe that's true, that, you know, we don't have enough coating around our myelin sheath to get a healthy thing going, you know, a healthy diet or a healthy lifestyle, or, you know, our body doesn't have the foundational materials to build upon to then have healthy, everything else.
There's that YouTube video, I don't know whether anybody's watched it, of Dr. Carrie Walls. She's an MD, and she got MS, I believe, multiple sclerosis, and was, you know, virtually paralyzed for a number of years, and no doctors could help her. They told her she was going to be that way for the rest of her life. Well, she went on the web. She said what she learned on the web was not taught in medical school, but basically, somehow she came across the paleo diet and started eating that, and with a lot of additional vegetables, I have to add. But within a very short time, I think it was months, she was able to walk again, then hike, then ride horses. I mean, she reversed MS by eating the paleo diet, you know, the higher fats, the protein, and a lot of vegetables. So, and her talk, it's about 17 minutes long, totally worth watching. Just thought I'd throw that in.
No, that's wonderful. No, I mean, you know, and that's, and I want to, you know, we'll jump back into something a little more, you know, I'll jump off my soapbox for a moment and talk about, because backstage we had talked about this earlier, about, you know, taking food as like, I don't know, I don't want to call food the enemy, but, you know, really getting back into the concept of food as pleasure. Having pleasure while you're eating your food, enjoying your food, not like it's punishment, not like you're restricted, not like you can't or shouldn't or won't or don't, that what you're eating is fulfilling and pleasurable.
I totally agree. And I don't know whether men have this as much as women. It just feels like women have more eating disorders than men. And having had one and gone through that, feeling like food was the enemy, and I felt guilty if I ate too much or anything. There was a whole weirdness around it. And, you know, that did follow me on into my life, and it's sort of interesting. I became a caterer and was in the food business. But yes, I would say you have to learn to love food, enjoy it, and it's the whole experience. It's going to the farmer's market and picking out the food. It's making a delicious meal. It's not just about the eating. And I believe all the aspects, and you being a chef as well, I know you can understand this, all the aspects of, you know, working with food is what is nourishing us. It's the love. It's the love of it. And so I believe that aspect of it is just as nourishing as the eating of it. It's the whole thing. And we're missing that in our culture today. It's fast food this, it's microwave that, it's like, I don't cook, it's too hard. You know, and I really believe it's a way to really heal ourselves, not just with eating the food itself, but the whole process of it really needs to be brought back into family life. You know, that's my deep feeling about it.
I think they need, you know, the phrase comes to mind, you know, happy molecule making, you know, meaning that the whole you know, I'll use the term art because I can't come up with another one, but I don't want it to be restrictive by using the word art. But I mean, the whole art of making a meal and then sharing that with others who want to come and, well, I mean, you and I know both had this experience. I haven't eaten with you yet, but it's going to happen. That the whole pleasure of having a dining evening with friends where you get together and they may or may not help you. If you've cooked professionally, people enjoy watching you cook because it's, you know, they can't believe you do that many things at once and that fast and all that. I mean, and that's always entertaining. I've done a lot of cooking with people where I do most of the cooking. And for me, that's real pleasurable. There's a lot of pleasure to it. And just that whole camaraderie of being around the kitchen and maybe having a glass of wine or, you know, some kind of, you know, vivation of choice, whether it's a digestive tonic or, you know, an herbal drink or, you know, I mean, whatever you want. And that family feel or that community gathering. And then I sort of juxtapose that about even sitting around in the days of sitting around, you know, oh my God, look, we have fire, you know, and we can cook this. We don't have to eat it raw. And there was still, even then, there was the tradition of, you know, passing stories on. And that being around the campfire, even if it's a really nice wood stove and a giant, you know, block and wonderful copper pans, it's still the same. We're gathering in an area, and we're sharing stories, and we're having pleasure, and it's happy molecule making.
Yes. I think it all goes together, definitely. And that is, it's that whole experience that is nourishing for our bodies, and we really need that now.
I think we really do, and I think it really adds to, I know, again, we had talked about this, that I think that's a missing link in part of what some people haven't gotten yet about the being together and cooking, that that's really part of the being, you know, having healthy time, is the pleasure of having that camaraderie and that sharing and that uptone vibe of the pleasure of gathering.
Yes. Yep.
And then sharing that process of the gathering, sitting down afterwards and having this really wonderful meal, even if it's something simple like a stir-fry dish or, pick any category. You know, it doesn't have to be something wrapped in parchment with, you know, blah, 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 and this, and, you know, herbs de Provence and all that,
I totally agree. I mean, what's better than some summer sliced tomatoes with a little goat cheese and a drizzle of olive oil and some basil leaves? It takes a couple minutes to put together. I mean, wow, it's just those pure flavors, and it doesn't have to be something elaborate. Actually, quite frankly, I'm a fairly simple cook when it comes right down to it. So, you know, I don't spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Well, and it doesn't have to be. I'm going to use this word because I know it annoys you. It doesn't have to be this whole like gourmet thing.
Yes,
you know,
we used
please.
That word yesterday. I hate the word gourmet. Amazingly
and
enough.
And it so doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to have a trained palate or a developed thing or have to gone someplace and taken a class to enjoy an amazing tomato with a really wonderful cheese and, you know, a splash of, you know, even balsamic vinegar or a grind of wonderful salt. Or a drizzle of basil oil. I mean, we can get all, you know, foodie, but it doesn't have, you know, it's about how it tastes. How does it feel? Does it make you happy when you eat it? I mean, it's really what it's about. And even for those of us that have cooked professionally, I think initially, well, I don't know that's as true now. That's, again, a separate show. That... back when I went, I was going to go into the whole culinary school thing, but that's, as I say, but that's a separate show. There were a lot of people, like even if I talk about somebody like Anthony Bourdain, as whacked as he is, may have been in his culinary career, he is somebody who gets great pleasure out of cooking. And there are most of us who did it professionally really started it because either we were too Asperger-y or too ADD or too HDHD, whatever that is, to go out into the world and really people couldn't cope with us. So we became chefs where all of that hyper-mental activity and the need to track many things and all that, and we became, you know, we really loved to cook.
Yeah.
And was that your experience? I've never asked you that. Was that how you got into cooking in the first place?
Well, actually, you know, I think I started cooking when I was about 11 years old. My mom wasn't a great cook. She didn't like it. So I think I started to take over. I learned how to bake things and make things. But for me, it was the whole sort of tactile, artistic part of making everything, the beautiful colors, the textures, everything. I just thought the whole experience was so wonderful. So anyway, it was the whole experience of the food for me. And I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley, which probably isn't the culinary destination of the world. But I lived in these small towns, usually on the outskirts of the town. So, I mean, we lived next door to Mr. Cap, who had his own chickens. So I'd go over and help him candle the eggs. He had a big garden in back. So I grew up tasting all the stuff out of the garden. I mean, there were fig trees. You know, the figs would drop on the ground. There were almond trees. I'd sit up in the trees and eat almonds. So what I feel I learned during that time was what real food tastes like, and it was that memory of the real food, you know, the pure taste that stayed with me, you know. And so that's what I enjoy today. I enjoy the real taste of the pure food, you know, unadulterated. That's why my cooking is kind of simple, I think.
Well, and I laughed. I watched a segment. There's a great segment on your website, a video interview somebody did with you, and you're talking. You're in the kitchen. Nice kitchen, by the way. Thank you. Very nice. That you were doing a segment, and you were talking about the fact that you don't, you know, you don't really like to take more than about 20 minutes to make dinner. That's it. That's what you got.
Yeah. I took a little longer last night. We had stuffed pasilla chilies, but it was worth it.
Oh, man, yeah. Yeah. So, but, I mean, that's the thing is sometimes, I mean, we won't go off into a whole culinary thing, but, I mean, there are times when you take, you know, half a day to develop a sauce or do a reduction or do something, but when all the flavors come together, it's just magic. It's like a symphony. It really is such a, you know, an amazing thing. And when you're doing it with whole foods, it's really stupendous. Go ahead.
Well, it is. I mean, a lot of people, you know, I can't speak for everyone, but there's sort of this resistance or resentment about going into the kitchen. I don't have to make dinner now. But I use that. I put on some great music. I have my little CD player in the kitchen. And it's like a meditation for me. I go in there and it's fun, you know, and 20, 30 minutes later, a great meal comes out of the kitchen. So you have to change your attitude about it and make it a fun thing.
Well, and I now I'm going to jump slightly because when you got into a relationship with your boyfriend, he was a grain hound. I mean that in a kind way. But he was a grain eater, and he came into a relationship with a person who was like didn't have grains in their repertoire, hadn't had bread dough under their nails in years. And, you know, here he is with this woman who's a great chef, and yet there's no grains. How was that transition? Because I think a lot of people are, there's a, you know, a fear about, oh, my God, you're going to take away my bread? You're going to take away my crackers? And how is that now?
Well, it's interesting. Our very first lunch together, we had at Farmstead Restaurant in St. Helena. And that restaurant is owned by a Long Meadow Ranch. They raise their own herd of grass-fed cattle. And I had already written my first book, so I was into the grass-fed meat thing. So we met there, had a really nice lunch. I talked about what I was doing and all of that, and as we got to know each other better, well, at that time, he weighed 250 pounds. He is tall, but still 250. I never made him change his diet or, I just did my thing, and when we moved up here to Nevada City, you know, I just cooked the paleo diet. No grains or whatever. We didn't take the bread out of the house or anything. Eventually, well, he lost 30 pounds without even trying. It was just eating this way most of the time. But then finally he said, just don't bring bread home anymore. You know, so incrementally he started to feel better and lost a lot of weight. As a result, so he's very happy now with what we're doing.
And is he grain free even when he's out and about in the world off the leash, so to speak? That he is just a grain,
a
grain free happy guy.
Yeah, when we go out to restaurants, I mean, you know, he'll eat whatever. But at home, this is what we do, and it's not a problem.
That's amazing. As I talk to people about it, and especially since our first interview with you, which I'll put the interview in the show notes. Actually, I put it in the show notes for Blog Talk Radio for people looking there. I put the link to the first interview because these two together would be really fun. Is that as I talk to people about it, and I actually have friends now who are texting me or emailing me saying, so what do you do about crackers? You know, they're like freaking out because there's things that in their minds are going away because they're good food eaters, quality food eaters. They eat everything organic and do everything, but it's like, what do I put that goat cheese on? You know, that kind of thing. It's
yeah.
Like, like bread is out of their life now, so they're, how do I make a sandwich? How do I do this? How do I do that? And that's a kind of an, I can't say awkward, you just have to, you know, what I call blur your vision, meaning you just have to soften your vision and open your mind to, you know, making a burger and having, you know, really wonderful romaine on each side, and it's crunchy and it's delicious and you still get all the flavor.
Right.
How do you, how do you transit, do you suggest people transition, or are you a cold turkey advocate?
Okay. Well, from my own experience, you know, when I first started the paleo diet 4 years ago, and I never thought I was gluten intolerant. I didn't think I had a problem with gluten, although in retrospect I can talk about that. But so I really did eliminate most grains. I was living with a bunch of vegetarians at the time, but I still liked my sandwich. I feel like I was unwilling to give up my sandwich. So I had the Alvarado sprouted, you know, grain bread, or I think there's another one too. And I continue to have my sandwich, you know, a couple times a week until a little over a year ago when I started experiencing the rash on my leg. And I thought, oh, my God, what is that? And I had told people to get tested with Enteric Lab or Cyrex Lab. So finally I bit the bullet and I got those tests, only to find out I was gluten intolerant and had been all my life, casein intolerant, soy and egg. And so that was a big surprise to me. And I really encourage people to get tested if you're having any kind of symptoms at all. And with the Cyrex Lab test, which is a blood test, it tests for 24 foods that your body may miss steak for gluten. So even if you're going to come off gluten and switch over to some of the other grains like, say, amaranth or quinoa or whatever, your body may still mistake those grains for gluten. So I think it's better just to be tested and find out. But a lot of grains still have the phytic acid and other sort of you know, phytotoxins and stuff like that. I know soy does. So even though a product or something says gluten-free, it still may be problematic for other reasons. So at that point, I went 100% gluten-free. So no gluten for me.
Right. And I would also add for people that, again, if Sherry would hear, she would chime in with the correct name of the software that they have at Sound Health Options, where they do food testing. They can do testing for for pyoluria or specific foods, so that you can, and you can actually learn to use an application that Sherry designed, or software that Sherry designed, called NanoVoice, to see, to pre-test yourself, do a vocal print, look at your voice print, and then eat a single food. Right, eat a single food and then wait about 20 minutes and look at your voice again. That's one way of doing it. And then they also do have specific software that's for allergy testing, where they can go in and look at you. You could work with a practitioner and actually have immediate results, so that you can see what's going on. Because I'm with Polly on this, that having testing as a foundational bit of information is a great tool, so that as you take things away, you can see how your body's feeling and see results. And that's one of the things I do like about either using the NanoVoice or the specific BioDiet or other software programs,
that you can test yourself
along the way.
Yeah, I'll post those on my Facebook pages. Well, you mentioned pyroluria, which actually, you know, I don't know whether we mentioned this in the last interview or not. I have the pyroluria. Hardly anybody's ever heard of it, but, you know, my mom had schizophrenia. And when I read Nora's book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, she had a couple pages in the back of the book about pyroluria. And I had about 20 of the 30 symptoms. So it's a urine test for that. that you said, you know, there's the voice test as well, which I find really interesting, but it's a vitamin B6 and zinc deficiency. So all my life I was excreting those essential nutrients instead of retaining them in my body. So thus the depression, I believe the bulimia started out as a zinc deficiency and all of that. So a lot of things over the course of my life, I, in retrospect, realized it was because of the pyroluria. And it's an easy test, like either the urine test or like you said, but get tested for it because you just have to supplement with vitamin B6 and zinc, and it can really solve a lot of problems, believe me. My depression went away after I started supplementing and also changed over to the paleo diet, which was higher in the fats and cholesterol, you know, for my brain. Within 3 months, my depression went away, and Richard, it has never come back. So,
wow, it's amazing.
That, that
I mean,
was,
it really
that,
is.
That
I mean, simple. I mean,
me.
Even though getting the testing done might have been tricky, or figuring that out was tricky, and yet the solution was fairly simple: B6 and zinc, and having a real diet. I mean, that's
yes.
That's the part that I love, is that ultimately it comes down to having a whole food diet. Which leads me
yes.
to ask you the question about why do you feel grass-fed beef is so important?
Well, you know, all the critics of the paleo diet, and you know, say, oh, we don't live in Paleolithic times. You know, we don't. You know, we're totally toxic now. Our environment, we could never replicate that diet. Well. The answer to that is yes, we probably cannot. However, the thing that we can try our best to replicate it, and by eating meat that's been totally raised on grass with no chemicals, or hormones or anything like that added to it. But the thing is, the grass retains the then the meat retains the omega-3 fatty acids and the vitamins and minerals from the grass. It stays in the meat. It stays in the fat. And that best replicates the wild meat of our ancestors. Those animals ate grass, and of course, in a pristine environment. But the reason why we were so successful as Homo sapiens is because of the high omega-3 fatty acid content as a result of eating the grass, but also that the vitamins and minerals stayed in the meat and fat as well. So that is the benchmark of the paleo diet, I believe, that makes it successful.
And that leads me, I concur, and that leads me to ask about, what about poultry? I hear so much talk about grass-fed beef, which I'm a fan of. Plus, it tastes amazing. What about poultry? What do we do about poultry? How do
okay,
we get poultry
well,
that's
just
the equivalent of grass-fed?
All right. Well, it's not that easy because there aren't that many people now who are raising chickens that get to run around outside and eat bugs and worms and seeds and be in the sunshine and all of that. Normally you would have to go to your farmer's market and make contact with, some of those people. Or maybe you might know someone in your town who has their own chickens. And I do see in the store now, at least in my area, in Nevada City, they are getting commercially raised, pastured chickens, you know, and the pastured chicken eggs are showing up. There's a whole egg marketing thing, as you know. Organic means nothing if they've been fed grains or, you know, being kept inside, free range means nothing. That means there's a door in their little house. They can go outside, but they're you know, pretty confined. So really, a free-range chicken is really a free-range chicken. They get to roam around. And, you know, my friend up in Washington has them. They get let out every day. They get to peck their way through the garden and all of that. And at nighttime, you know, they're back inside. But pretty much during the day, they're out there on the loose.
So we're really looking, so the phrase I'm looking for is the equivalent of grass-fed. So what we're looking for is really a pasture or a range-fed chicken? Is that kind of the key phrase?
It's very difficult now because of all of our labeling, and there's, you know, there's a lot of deception. I would look for the word pastured. Pastured is the definitive word. Free range might not mean anything, or organic may not even mean anything anymore. You know, it has to be pastured. That means they get to run around and eat bugs and worms and seeds and all of that. So
they eat, like, dare I say, chickens.
What?
Like they eat like regular old chickens. I mean, that's the idea of,
yeah,
you know, a range or a pasture,
you know,
chicken, is that they eat like chickens. I know it's a shocking concept, but, you know, that's what chickens eat.
Yeah. Think of the barnyard chicken. And they eat table scraps, you know. Chickens are sort of carnivores. They'll eat meat, too. So at any rate, and the thing about their eggs, you can always tell their eggs, they're the orange yolk. Very bright, and it tastes so good. You know, I traveled in Mexico for a number of years. You know, you always eat chickens in everybody's yard, and the chickens down there taste wonderful. And the eggs, you know, you'd go out to eat for breakfast, the yolks would be a bright orange, and they taste so much better. It's like the same thing, you know, you talk about with the grass-fed meat. Well, real good chicken eggs have a whole other good taste.
They have a wonderful taste. And also, I'll say, from having broken a few billion eggs in my life, I was a chef once in a restaurant where 4 days a week we serve brunch, and so I've made bazillions of eggs. Real range-fed chicken eggs are not so easy to crack open. I mean, they're not
right.
Like the commercial eggs that you pick up and almost crumble when you're trying to break them open.
Yeah.
A range-fed chicken's egg is an egg. It's a serious thing that, you know, you really got to whack to get that thing open. And that alone is a great clue to me, at least. When I break open an egg at a friend's house, I don't have to know anything about that egg. All I have to do is crack it open. And just from how it cracks, you can kind of get a sense of, you know, if this poultry has, you know, a high mineral diet, has a more of a full spectrum range diet, merely by how the egg cracks open. Now, I've done that a lot, way more than anybody in their lifetime should. However, that being said, it's really, that's a great clue, is that when you break an egg open, how does that egg break open? And if you compare the blanched, white, pale, spooky-looking, you know, ghosty-looking egg compared to a range-fed egg... Yeah, it's, you know, it doesn't hold as well together. The albumin and the egg isn't holding as well together. The yolk is certainly a different world. It's a range-fed chicken is a beautiful thing.
Well,
that's my wrap-up
on
the range-fed chicken. It's a beautiful thing.
It is. Well, you know, we started off talking about the fats and cholesterol. Well, we need that cholesterol from the egg yolk. But the other thing we need, because of the pastured chickens, is the vitamin D3. And the pastured chicken eggs are higher in vitamin D3. You know, when I first started working with Nora as my nutritionist, we had my D3 levels checked, and they were like 50% of what they should have been. And in the U.S., you know, our vitamin D3 levels are really, really low. And that's another reason for a lot of our brain problems. I mean, vitamin D3 figures in a lot of different metabolic processes in the body. So it's one of the most important vitamins. So I supplement with vitamin D3, too. That's one of the supplements I take.
There's a lot of, I belong to a group where they talk a lot about vitamin D research, and they've been doing a series of lectures talking about vitamin D doses for pregnancy. And these are medical doctors. And they're talking about sort of typical during pregnancy be taking approximately 5,000 units a day during the pregnancy cycle, which is sort of in my realm of vitamin D usage, that's sort of a typical dosage anyway. It keeps your immune system up. It's the myriad of positive effects, the cascade effect of taking vitamin D on a daily basis is really fabulous. So I'm very pro.
Yeah, that's about what I take every day too. Mm-hmm. I take about that amount.
Yeah. So now I want to jump back because I have a personal technical question. You mentioned something about colic, and I happen to have a new baby, not me personally, but in my realm of friends who has colic. So talk to me about colic, if you would, please.
Well, I'd be happy to. Well, that's a horrible thing for the new mother and the child because my daughter just screamed, and I just didn't know what to do. The doctors, you know, they didn't know what to do either. But since that time, about a year ago, and I had been hearing about this book for quite a while, The GAPS Diet, Gut and Psychology Syndrome by Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride. Well, to make a long story long, we evolved, you know, during Paleolithic times with healthy gut microbes. I mean, we live close to the earth. So, you know, we were eating a little bit of soil or dirt with our food. Nothing was probably washed all that much or whatever. But at any rate, I believe our immune systems were much stronger then because of the diet and the good fats. But, you know, as we started to eat grains about 10,000 years ago, it changed, I believe, the microbe profile in our guts. People started to get diseases that they hadn't gotten before and all of this stuff. So as we have progressed since the industrial age and then added, processed foods and refined foods and more of that, and then more recently genetically modified foods. Well, I believe now the reason why we're experiencing all these illnesses is we have pathogenic gut bacteria happening in our systems. And this really made sense to me. Dr. Campbell McBride said when a baby passes through the birth canal during the process of birth, it picks up either the healthy bacteria of the mother or the pathogenic bacteria of the mother. But, you know, when the baby's in the womb, it doesn't have any bacteria in its system at all. But during the birth process, it will pick up whatever the mother has. So I know I had pathogenic gut bacteria. And so that was passed to my daughter, and then, you know, that gut bacteria, pathogenic, starts to grow inside the baby's system as well and starts to wreak havoc. I'm sure she had gas, inflamed intestines, all of that, a lot of pain. You know, she would cry and her little legs would kind of curl up and everything, and she was in great distress. And once Dr. McBride sort of explained all that, well, the light bulb went off because that's what was happening. And now with the rise in autism, we know that during the birth process, the baby picks up a lot of pathogenic bacteria. And now Dr. McBride and a lot of other doctors are making the association between the pathogenic gut bacteria and the problems with the brain. So she cured her son's autism by changing his diet. She has this whole protocol of removing all sugars and starches from the diet, giving the child nourishing bone broth and egg yolk and things like that, because the good fats help coat the inside of the intestine and soothe it. And then, the healing process can take place. And this can work for adults as well. But that is the story behind colic.
That's That's a great story. That's a whole nother show. That's a wonderful story. I will be emailing people
really
immediately
is.
Afterwards because it all comes. I'm a big fan of probiotics and all things gut beneficial because my research down through the years has really led me toward something that we don't directly get is that the gut is the foundation of our health. I mean, that's where it all kind of starts. I mean, that's where, you know, everything gets broken down and turned all the micronutrients we need and all the, you know, breaks everything down. So it really is the foundation of our health. So that
well,
if you have something askew
or,
like you say, a pathogen in there that's gone awry, you're in trouble to start with, or you're in tricky waters, I guess I'll say.
Well, I guess I'm the world's slowest learner, but what I've realized since reading her book and a few other books on gut microbes, Honor Thy Symbionts is a really good one. So make a note of that, Honor Thy Symbionts. But what I realize now is that when I went over to or started the Paleolithic diet, I believe it changed my pathogenic gut bacteria changed to more of a probiotic situation in there, and that is one of the reasons my depression cleared up as well. If the paleo diet changes your gut profile, the microbes, to a more healthy one, automatically, you know. So I realized that's what happened. With it.
And do you think I can use the term creme fraiche could be a gateway drug to a healthy gut?
Definitely.
Because creme
I've been making
is a fermented,
my own here.
Right, because creme fraiche is a fermented food. Is that not true?
Yes. Yes.
And fermentation is kind of the whole foundation of getting, you know, like this whole insurgence of fermented foods, whether it be something like a kimchi, although that's a little too processed. But, you know, sauerkrauts and a lot of these fermented foods, you know, are beneficial to the gut. So therefore, creme fraiche, and now that means that you have to tell us what creme fraiche is and how you make your own creme fraiche, and then why people want to stop now and hang up on the call and go buy this product and make creme fraiche. Because it's a miracle. Creme fraiche is a miracle, I'm telling you.
It sure is. Just a big dollop of it on some berries. Wow, what a fabulous dessert. Well, you only need 2 or 3 teaspoons of, a cultured starter. And I actually, there's a grocery store up here, they make their own creme fraiche, so I went and got some of that. And then I just take a pint of organic whipping cream, whisk in a couple or 3 teaspoons of the starter stuff, and let it sit out on the counter in a mason jar for 24 hours, and voila, the next day you have your stuff. And then you can keep using a couple teaspoons of that the next time, so you can kind of keep it going. Always keep some creme fraiche in the refrigerator. Oh, but the other thing I wanted to talk about, since we were on to, we were talking about fermented foods, what I've learned recently as well is that when you eat a lot of non-starchy, fibrous vegetables, they actually start to ferment in your lower gut. So that's why we're adding a lot of vegetables to our diet, non-starchy, fibrous vegetables, because that can create a probiotic situation in your gut all by itself. So your gut will make its own probiotics. Isn't that something?
Isn't that amazing? You know, the gut, you know, the body is really, it is truly a miracle in that it's really, given the opportunity, the body will heal itself. I know that sounds like some old hippie vegetarian from the 60s saying something, but it is really true. As you just said, if you eat, you know, foods that are, and it's not tricky foods. It's just healthy, you know, good foods, and the body, the gut will take that and begin to reflorize itself, I guess I would call it.
You know, totally. And even at my age, in my, you know, now past mid-60s, it worked. So, you know, that's what I'm telling people. You know, just start doing it. And I don't know, you probably have read Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Belief.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
At any rate, I just feel like any time that you make a decision to be healthier and you start moving in that direction, even if you take baby steps, that sends a message, a fundamental message to your cells and your DNA that you are being proactive in your own health. And that decision alone, I believe, starts the process to healing.
I agree completely. And Bruce, you know, would absolutely jump on that with both feet, that it really is the decision. You know, once you send that message out to all your cells and they all start bouncing it around, they're going, yeah, okay, we've made the decision. You know, hormones and I think that are really like a giant, you know, billiard table or a pool, you know, depending upon one of those felted tables with balls bouncing around, where once you make the decision, that message goes out to your cells, and they go, okay, we got the message. Let's go.
Yeah. I feel like our consciousness, our mind, and our body, they're all connected. They're not separate. You know, so it's all going to work together.
That is really the truth. This, you know, as I often say in shows, our cells are listening.
Yes.
And they really are. I mean, they really are listening. They're really waiting for the message. That's how the hormone system works, which is always miraculous to me once I figured that out, that, you know, really we have the lymphatic system, we have the circulatory system with blood, we have lots of systems in the body. Hormones are glands that secrete something systemically, meaning it's just in the body. Boom, there is no ducting, there is no tubing, there are no pipes. You know, a gland decides, like the, you know, pituitary decides to send out a message, and it just squirts this thing into the system, and all of a sudden it's like, boom, it's out. It's there. And that's the wonderful thing about that system, is, and that's part of what Bruce Lipton is talking about, is the cells have these little antennas on them, and they get these messages, and they're looking for the message.
So
it's a very
totally
exciting
believe.
Thing.
Yeah. You know, we already know that there's chemical messages, but I truly believe there's sort of these, like, electrical or thought messages that are even faster than the chemical messages. So, I mean, wow, I truly believe we can change everything by our kind of thinking and our intention.
Well, and I think we can, I would add to that, I think we can change everything by our thinking and intention and supplying our body with the tools to assist in that change. So as we eat good food, you know, we're support, because we can't, I don't think we can change eating a Big Mac into healthy grass-fed beef by just thinking it's healthy grass-fed beef. I think our cells are confused when we do that. And when we support our body by giving it the nutrition.
You can't fool Mother Nature.
And there you have it. She's got a rolling pin, and she means it. She's not fooling around. Give me the right product, and I will, you know, do what you want. But don't be feeding me, you know, we don't have Big Mac as a sponsor, and I'm not picking on them. I'm just using that as a, you know, allegorical tool, that, you know, that kind of thing. We can't sit around and eat refined, bad, you know, tricky foods that our bodies don't know what to do with, because they really don't. You know,
but
that's one of the issues with wheat, is that, you know, it's been so messed up and so GMO'd and so Monsantoized that our bodies are completely clueless as what to do with it. It's this
weird
project gone awry.
Totally. Well, it's the same thing. It's our prime gut bacteria, our evolutionary gut bacteria that's been passed on all these years, that does not recognize these fast foods or these fake foods. They don't know what to do with it. So they experience it as a foreign invader, a toxic substance, and so they send out an immune response or whatever, and all this inflammation happens, and then the inflammation helps bore, you know, holes in our gut. We get leaky gut and all kinds of other things. So there, it just creates this warlike situation in our system.
Which leads me, you'd think we practice this backstage. That leads me to ask you about why clarified butter.
Oh, why clarified butter? Well, a couple of reasons. You know, if you're casein sensitive like I am, clarifying the butter, you know, in French cooking they call it clarified butter, in Indian cooking they call it ghee. It's the same thing, though, but it removes all the milk solids and salts and everything. So what you wind up with is just the oil. And the oil actually is great for cooking because you can cook at really high temperatures, then it won't burn. It's the other ingredient in butter that when you heat it too high, it starts to burn. But that won't be happening with the clarified butter or ghee. And also, you know, I truly believe it's almost like a medicine. It's so nourishing for our cells. You know, in Indian cooking, in Ayurvedic medicine, they use ghee, you know, as a healing substance.
Yeah, imagine a culture, such as you say, the Indian culture, where they actually have a fat as a healing substance. Versus
yes.
We've been, you know, so carbohydrate-driven that we've gone completely away fats as healthy foods the other direction, whereas we still have cultures like the Indian cultures where they believe fat is a, you know, a nutritive, has nutraceutical qualities to it, which it totally does. I mean, it makes sense completely. And I think that's really the reason I wanted to sort of move the direction of talking about butter is that what I would call trick is the casein issue for those that are lactose intolerant, that by cooking it like that you are removing the casein issue so you have the pure golden fat, which is then, you know, an amazing thing to cook with. It's delicious.
It is.
It's amazing, I'm telling you.
Well, you know, I just did this little video with a friend, and it's posted on my website now, and I show how to make the ghee. It's so simple. So if you want to learn about that, go to theprimalcuisine.com and watch the little video on ghee making.
And also make sure that you, I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'm going to butcher this. However, I have to go back and watch that video because I so want to get the recipe more in grasp for the Syrian schmear, the muhammara.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the magical muhammara. Actually, when I lived in the Napa Valley, I made three products that I sold, spreads, and that was one of them, and it was the best seller. It is so fantastic. I'm telling you, this will be the best spread you have ever eaten, and you can use it as a dip with vegetables or, you know, seed crackers, or just put it on grilled fish or chicken or something like that. But I call it the thinking man's hummus. It's made from walnuts and not garbanzo beans. It's real spicy. You will love that. And the recipe
it's
is
so
in the
made
cookbook.
It's so made me want to have a baby romaine, which is one of my favorite vehicles for smearing things onto because it's crunchy and moist and slightly sweet. That and a big glob of goat cheese and some of the muhammara on there would be just like I would be in heaven. It's just an amazing combination of flavors.
I love all those Middle Eastern foods, olives and all that, and they make great snacks, you know. And highly recommended, the magical muhammara.
And what a great device to have, or vehicle, to, I'll use the ridiculous word, crudité, you know, they have vegetables that are cut up into cute little pieces and perhaps slightly blanched just because I like that texture personally.
And then
to have the muhammara to drag that through, it would be just, I can see parties that I go to where I bring something and I can just see that people will be on that like, you know, I don't know what, I could come up with something cinematic. You know, they would just be totally on it. I could see them going nuts because it's such a wonderful flavor profile.
Well, I think it's a good way to get the kids to eat vegetables. I have a couple other. Well, the Caesar salad dressing in the cookbook is just fantastic. I always have that at home too. But some of the other dips and dressings, just to have around and for the kids, you know, for a snack. They can get out some of their favorite dips and dressings and some vegetables and have that. You don't need the chips and crackers.
Well, and even for the older kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I know
definitely.
A bunch of adults who still, you know, act like kids when it comes to eating. Like, I don't want to eat the vegetables. I don't like, you know, put some of this on it and just, you know, love that down. I mean, that's an amazing
well, you
thing.
Saw Janaya and I, we were doing the food demonstration, and then we just took the top right off of the Cuisinart, and we're eating the vegetables with our mouths full.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Kind of
on that was actually very funny.
Later.
You're on camera, and you were both chewing it down so much, you were like, "We'll have a moment of silence while we chew. We can't help ourselves."
We just wanted to dive right into it.
Oh, yeah. Now, as soon as I saw it blended, as you know, if you have cooked enough, when you watch something made, you begin to get that flavor profile in your mouth because you've done so much cooking, you kind of know what something's like. And I watched you make it. It was immediately like, I wanted some now. After the show,
yes.
I'll be going out. I'll be getting organic walnuts. I'll be getting some peppers. I'll be firing them up and making a big vat of that. And, you know, it's just...
Yeah, well, you will love it.
Fabulous. Then I love that tip you gave about back to the clarified butter, which sounds, you know, all the foundational things that we're talking about really are very simple. This whole idea of either ghee, which always sounds very exotic and tricky, is very simple to make your own ghee or clarified butter. And the same as, you know, that really wonderful thing where you said you save the stuff in the bottom of the pan, and then you'll pour that over vegetables, or you'll pour that on a, you know, a cooked spaghetti squash. You know, that there's a lot of way you can get flavor, multiple uses out of it, you know, like making clarified butter. You then take the pan that the butter was clarified in, and you slop something around in there, and I mean that nicely, and it adds wonderful flavor to dishes, and you're using everything from as many levels as possible.
It's delicious.
All right.
Yep.
We all need to go to lunch now, I can tell. We're moving toward the end of the show, which is shocking. We could obviously talk about this category or any of these arenas for hours. What would be like two of your favorite tips for people to just begin to move toward the primal cuisine diet beside, and of course having your cookbook, which I put in the show notes, having your cookbook and reading it and beginning to look at the pictures and being engaged in that, what are a couple of tips of people moving that direction? Like, where would they start or how do they get there?
Okay, well, I think one of the first things to do is to go to your kitchen cupboard and refrigerator and really take a real look at what's in there and get rid of any processed foods or bottled dressings that are made from GMO ingredients and all of that. It's going to actually make life a lot simpler for you because you're going to have to shop for less. When you go to the store, you're going to get a few things. You're going to get your fresh vegetables, your salad greens. You're going to go to the meat counter and get your some grass-fed beef or your pasture chicken or whatever. You're not going to have to deal with grains or that side dish, that potato, and all of that. You're just going to have more vegetables and salads with your meat. So I think that's a good way to start. I have lots of really interesting sort of egg and breakfast ideas in the book. I advocate bacon for, you know, breakfast. So, you know, since I'm a little sensitive to eggs, I'll just have the bacon. I get the Lino Secco bacon that's from Davis or Chico that's totally pastured pigs and humanely raised. So, you know, when you go to the store, just start identifying some of these products that you're going to work with. And also go to the farmers market, because those people, you know, some of your ethical farmers are going to be showing up there that are raising, you know, the pastured animals. Like over here at our farmers market, we have somebody who raises lamb and the pastured chickens and the beef and stuff like that. So you start learning your sources for these ingredients. I have a whole list of ingredients and sourcing in my cookbook, so that should help, you know, make things easier. And there are producers where you can order the meats and stuff, and they'll arrive at your doorstep too. So if you're out of
and
the
where
range
do people
of
and where do people find your cookbook? Do they go to theprimalcuisine.com?
Okay. Well, wow, my cookbook is now in Costco and Sam's Club. So if you
wow.
go to Costco or Sam's Club, I know. You can pick it up there. You can go to the Amazon website, and actually they have a peek inside feature where you can read a lot of the beginning text of the book and see the table of contents. So you can really get a really good preview of the book. Or you can go to the Barnes & Noble website as well. So there's a lot of different ways to get the book now.
Wonderful. And do you ever do any, do you do classes and workshops intermittently?
I teach paleo classes up here in Nevada City. I just did a class and a food demonstration down in Yuba City yesterday. They have a big sort of paleo group happening there. They have two CrossFit clubs. Those people are really into paleo. So we had about 20 people show up. They want me to come back and do the class on fats. And so I think I'll be doing that. But, yeah. And I also do personal consultation, you know, over the phone. So you can go to my website and see everything I'm up to on there.
Wonderful.
Actually, I'm going to do a there's a couple of ladies I met up here that have a TV station, and we're going to do a program on the paleo diet, and we might do a few programs. So that's going to be happening soon as well. You know, there aren't very many.
So we should check into your site and follow that to see that.
Yeah, I always
programs
put,
for those that are in other parts
up.
Of the coast.
Exactly. I'll post everything on my website. But the thing is, you know, there aren't any TV shows or anything like that on the paleo diet now that I know of. So we want to try to do a few pilot shows and see if we can get more people interested in what this diet actually looks like and what it involves, you know, just so people, it's like going to be like a show and tell, so there won't be this mystery behind it. Maybe I'll be the new Paleo Polly on TV.
I don't know. Polly's in tricky waters. That's a tricky area. I don't know. Yeah, that would be great. No, that would be fabulous,
yeah.
Because I think it really is, that's why I kind of wanted to talk about things like creme fraiche and clarified butters. And, you know, so that it's demystifying, it isn't so scary. It is all really approachable and doable. And once you begin to move this direction, it becomes part of your lifestyle. And, I mean, I can taste fresh organic strawberries with creme fraiche on them. When you talk about it, I'm going nuts.
Yeah.
So and once you've done it, and once you've started incorporating it and see how easy it is to make your own creme fraiche and have that around and use that as a condiment, it's an amazing thing. I mean, it's a wonderful, and it's all doable. And that's what I love about your cookbook. It's a very doable cookbook. You know, the recipes are all approachable and doable.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, Polly, it's been a blast as always. Thank you ever so much. I know. It's an hour already, and we didn't even get going, and we're, you know. Wow.
All righty.
Thank you so much, Polly. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Richard.
Let's all send Sherry vibes for feeling better and rested.
Yes, Sherry.
And we'll be back next week. Thanks, everybody. Alrighty. It was a great show. Thank you, Polly.
Thanks a
lot. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.